This is Joe Meyer. We're broadcasting live from Freedom Rectangle. Main Street runs right through it. I've got a young lady who wants to just give a little shout out, and we're happy to let her do it.
I just want to give a little shout out to my husband, Rick.
Sorry,
love
do that again.
You, baby.
Do it again. Do it again. I forgot to turn the mic.
A little shout out for my husband, Rick.
I like the sound of that. Tony's joining us in our portable studio. Tony, would you like to introduce yourself and your role in Occupy Portland, please?
My name is Tony Zilka. I am union outreach, and I deal with unions, getting union support. I've dealt a lot with Jobs with Justice and AFL-CIO.
That's really interesting. What kind of background did you have for that, or do you have a background in that?
Zero.
Okay. And how do you go about doing that? Looking in the phone book and getting a phone number?
Yeah, just started out just sort of calling people, ATU 757, talking with people like Barbara Dudley, of getting advice of how to go about getting union support. I started out just sort of winging it. I knew that this niche had to be filled, so I just decided to fill it.
Interesting. A lot of things we're talking about today that I find interesting is how decisions are made. Did you go before the General Assembly with this idea, or...?
No, I knew that it had to be done. I was here at the second General Assembly of the entire start of Occupy Portland.
Which was a week ago today, or two weeks ago today?
It was, I think it was almost 3 weeks ago that we had our second General Assembly.
Was that before the big march on the 6th?
Yeah,
even?
Before the march, okay. About a week before the march.
I'm always curious about that early history. Once you mention that, I need to know more.
Well, basically, I got there at the second General Assembly. I had heard about Occupy Wall Street, and as soon as I heard about Occupy Portland, I was about it.
And right on. Who was putting that together? How'd you hear about it?
I heard about it through my friend Owen Wise. He just posted something on Facebook about Occupy Portland. He had been there for the first General Assembly at Powell's Books, and as soon as I saw the words Occupy Portland, I was on fire.
Right. Interesting. Were there organizers from New York coming here to get started, or how'd that happen?
No, it was pretty much just an autonomous thing of people who wanted to get involved.
Homegrown?
With the Occupy Wall Street movement. Mm-hmm.
Any political parties or the progressives active at the beginning, or Greens? Or
it was pretty much just people.
Humans.
No, not a lot of unions there. Just
humans.
Humans. I thought you said unions. Yeah, so it was just a lot of people that came together.
Really an organic movement here in Portland, and you're using, I guess, the Occupy brand or something was what caught your eye and said, yeah, that's what I'm at. That's what I'm about.
Yeah. And I really wanted to go to Occupy Wall Street, but, you know, financial issues and social issues, things
sure,
like that.
Sure, then who are you going to pay to get there? You're going to pay the corporations anyway, so there's your protest in a way.
Yeah.
That's my excuse. Can you set the scene for that second GA that you were at then?
Well, so I show up.
Powell's again? Or
no, it wasn't Powell's. It was underneath the Burnside Bridge where the Palisades are for the relatively new Saturday Market area. So I get off work. I work on the Portland Spirit. I get off work about 6 o'clock, just sort of waiting around for people to show up. And as I sit there, people start sort of coming in around 6:30. There's about 30 people there. And then 6:45, there's like 75.
How would you describe the crowd? Hipsters? I don't know. I need categories. I'm a radio reporter.
I'd say everyone from all walks of life. I'd say if you walk down the streets of Portland, it would be just that demographic,
that cross section,
people that you see. There are people in ties and people with dreadlocks dipped in patchouli, and young kids just like me. And so about 150, 300 people showed up for the second General Assembly.
Was it a good area? Here we have an amphitheater, which seems quite handy. Was it just like a flat parking lot? Or?
It was an okay area. Not really the best. It was just sort of like a walkway and just Yeah, just like a metal barricade, and not the best place for it.
Yeah, a lot has been made about the leaderlessness of the movement. So how did the meeting start? Did someone have a gavel?
Well, you know, I like what one of our media people said, is that we're not a leaderless movement, we're a movement of leaders.
Okay. Okay, did one of the leaders have a gavel at the second meeting?
Yeah, one of the first organizers of the group, Josh, sort of facilitated the meeting, proposed that we break up into committees, and they had the committees proposed of what we'd have. It was just sort of the basic committees: outreach, media, sanitation wasn't even on it. I had to raise my hand and be like, "Hey, you're forgetting sanitation." And so we broke up into those committees, and there was a union committee that was formed, but sort of as we got into the occupation,
I'm so curious about the decision-making process. Did people shout out what they thought would be a good idea, and someone wrote it down, and then that's what happened? Or did you vote on things at that point?
What they did was they had a list of about 14 different committees, and they read them off and gave spirit fingers. Got a temperature check of whether that should be a committee or not.
Right. I've seen that the General Assembly still, when they're trying to decide on something, they like to give a temperature check.
Yeah.
And the sign for you liking something is to put your hands in the air and wiggle your fingers.
Yes.
And sometimes if you look around, there's not many fingers wiggling, then you just say, well, let's do that later.
Yeah.
And it seems like that works pretty well.
Yeah, it does.
That's great. So we're back at the second meeting now, which is a week before the 6th March.
Yeah, I forget the actual date.
Okay, but that was your first meeting in... Josh was, hosting it. That's not the right word, though. He was the mediator, facilitator.
Yeah.
Right. And you guys decided to break up into about 16 different groups.
Mm-hmm.
Did you choose communications at that point or union at that point?
I chose sanitation.
Sanitation, because you suggested it.
Yeah.
You're stuck in that case.
Well, I essentially chose the committee that had the least amount of people in it.
Ah.
Because I knew sanitation was a really important thing, so I went and gotten that. But... since then, I've had an injury. I got stitches in my hands.
Oh.
So I'm like, oh, well, I guess it's not a very good idea for me to be going around picking up trash.
Yeah, you're disqualified in that regard.
Yeah, which is, oh, it's too bad. I can't wash dishes.
Yeah. Was the date for the march decided on at that meeting?
I don't quite remember. I think the date for the march had already been decided.
Okay.
We didn't really vote on it. I think it was just kind of unanimous. I think they decided for the date of the march on the first General Assembly.
Okay. Okay. And that was at Powell's some few weeks before March.
I think it was about 3 days before the second General Assembly.
Okay. And were you involved in organizing for the march?
No.
You went right to sanitation.
Yeah, and I was there for every pre-occupation meeting until the occupation. So, I guess I was involved a little bit in the planning of the march. Just at that point, I've never been involved in any of this political activism, and I didn't really know how to really voice my opinion about this stuff, so I didn't know anything.
It seems like they have a pretty well-developed communication method with a bunch of different hand signals to use.
Yeah.
Can you tell our listeners something about that? I guess you had to learn that as well.
So...
Is there a name for it, even?
I guess it's just a campy method of of figuring out democracy. So do you want me to just do a rundown?
Yeah, let's do a rundown. What are some of the top hand movements?
So, well, let's say someone's making a proposal to have people pick up their trash. They'd say, let's get a temperature check of this proposal, and people would put up their fingers and do spirit fingers, and if they like it, they do spirit fingers. If they don't like it, they do puppy dog hands. Hands up, turned over.
Oh,
like you're pouting.
Oh, I haven't seen that much actually.
Yeah. And then there is a point of process, which is you put your hands in sort of an A over your head.
Make a triangle,
a little triangle, so it's a little point. And that's basically if the facilitators are not going by the correct process, or if you're just sort of like correcting them. And there is a direct response, which is you take your hands and sort of do a karate chop.
Back and forth, keeping your wrist about the same place, and forth.
And that's to sort of clarify with factual information.
Okay.
Not like...
Not bringing in new ideas yet. Just clarifying.
Factual clarification. So you can't be like, you know, fact, the police are screwy bastards.
Right. I get you. Just the facts.
Yeah. And so one that I actually proposed, and it got passed and has been being used, is when someone's not speaking loud enough, you raise the roof.
Oh, nice.
You put your hands up. And,
nice.
Yeah.
I had thought it was an old CAM system that you guys imported from some website, and it seems like you're making it up as you go along.
Well, yeah, a lot of it is, a lot of this movement has been copied and evolved from the Occupy Wall Street movement. But these methods have been around for a really long time. General consensus has been an evolving method for thousands of years. And just adding these new hand signals was probably from people who were, you know, ex-camp counselors or something, found a fun way to get general consensus.
Well, I think fun is a big part of the recipe. Yeah. You mentioned you weren't active much before this. What brought you out?
Well, I guess it's kind of a personal thing. My ex-girlfriend actually left me to go to Occupy Wall Street, and you know, she had gotten me really revved up about it before, you know, before she left me, and I was like, yes, we're going to go to Occupy Wall Street, it's going to be awesome, it's going to be amazing. And then she's like, oh, I'm going to go by myself. And I'm like, oh, great.
And is she still there?
She's still there.
Wow.
She's she's
camping out.
She's big in it. She's not camping out anymore. She camped out the first couple weeks, but got pretty sick apparently, and then decided to, you know, stay inside and sort of work from home.
Can you say something more about your outreach to the unions, how that's working?
Yes. I wanted to do a plug about our march on Wednesday at Director Park at 5 o'clock.
Where's Director Park?
Director Park is on 9th in between Morrison and Salmon, right next to Elephant Delicatessen.
There's a fountain there. Is there a fountain there?
Yeah.
15 bus stop is right there?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. What time was that again?
It's at 5 o'clock.
What's the theme going to be?
The theme is a march for the unions. It's a big labor march, and we're hoping to get 10,000 people out for it. We want huge numbers.
Wow.
It's going to be a beautiful march, beautiful speakers, and it's basically a march for the people, for the 99%. And we want to prove to people that it's not just a bunch of, you know, young kids out here doing this. It's the steel workers and the contractors and the longshoremen and the people who work on the parks. And it's going to be a really amazing mix of people out here coming out for this march.
Do you feel like the unions are willing and ready to take over some of the language? Like, for example, you mentioned 99%. Is that something they're happy to embrace?
Yes. They've been embracing it pretty heavily. Just getting letters of support from the unions. They use the 99% quite a bit. Words like solidarity. 99% has become such a buzzword. It sort of rolls off the tongue. A lot of people have been saying.
Yeah, well, I had a guest the other day who thought it was exclusionary, and it really ought to be 100%.
Yeah, that'd be nice. That'd be really cool if we could get that other 1% to sort of side with us. But then, where's the fight?
Yeah, it's only a matter of time, I guess.
Yeah.
I've been asking a lot of my guests to tell just a little bit about their personal arc, how you ended up here. You know, I've had a 91-year-old gentleman here who's serving in the army and so forth, and I wonder if you can just give our listeners a little idea of how you got here today. Were you born in Portland, for example, stuff
oh,
like
yeah.
that?
Yeah,
born and raised
Portland, Oregon.
And public schools.
Yeah, went to Grant High School.
Grant High School. Did you play soccer? I know they got a famous team for that.
No, I didn't play soccer. I was big into theater.
Did you?
Yeah.
And mostly, did you enjoy your public school experience? Would you say?
I loved public school. I had a really good time.
All right.
You know, a couple grievances, but I think it's what you make of it.
Yeah. And did you get a chance to explore theater at Grant, would you
oh,
say?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was where I learned to do what I love.
Fantastic. And after that?
After that, I graduated high school, thought I was going to go off to college, enrolled in PCC. I was there for about a semester and a half, and then my theater career started sort of taking off. I was in a feature-length movie, I was in a big play, and I was in a dance team, and I was like, well, you know, if I'm doing what I want to do with the rest of my life, then why am I at college? So I dropped out and started pursuing more heavily this theater career, and that was pretty fun.
Great.
I had a really good time doing that, but I've sort of taken a break from the theater world to come and do this occupation stuff.
Awesome. Do you see any specific changes coming out of this? Another thing people don't like to talk about are demands. I'm not going to call it demands, but are there anything you'd like to see to make a brighter tomorrow?
Well, I think that October is coming to a close. October was the month that, you know, we rally the people. Everybody gets together under one banner, and November is going to be the month of change. November, everything is going to start changing. Everything that we said was going to happen is going to start happening.
In the political system, you mean? Or
I think that the people are going to make the change. There's the big bank transfer day that people have been talking about, and a couple other hush-hush things that are going to start happening.
Okay. So we're going to start taking action in November.
Yes.
We're rallying people together, building community. In November, the action starts. And one thing you mentioned is the banks, withdrawing your money from the big national banks and what, going to your local credit union.
Yes, putting them into credit unions.
And do you have an idea how big that's going to be? Are you asking people to sign up to do it, or just trying to get the word out, or how's that campaign going?
Well, what I'm doing personally is with another person in outreach named James. We're having a wine and cheese social on Sunday. We're inviting some local businesses, some medium-sized businesses to come in and just talk with us. And a lot of union representatives are coming, and hopefully some more people from credit unions are coming, so that we can facilitate the process of transferring their funds into a credit union as opposed to a big bank.
Oh, that sounds like a great one. You want to give a little more plug for that? And where and when is that going to be? Is it open to the public, or?
It's RSVP only.
I see.
So I think...
And you're filled up by now?
I don't think we're filled up. I don't know if I could give his number over the air.
That's fine.
That'd be a bad idea.
Let's not do it. Anything else you want to say to people listening out there?
Come down and hang out. If you come down here and hang out for an hour, just... talk to people, don't talk to people, do whatever you feel like doing. I guarantee that your view of the movement and possibly even your view of the entire world will be completely changed.
Well, Tony, thanks for stopping by, and we're going to be looking for change starting in November, like you say.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Hey, we need to talk to you.
Sure.
Yeah,
wait, did you say that was awful?
Because most Americans are passive consumers of information, and very few are proactive. And the internet's only useful if you're proactive. I would say that we are the most illusioned society on the planet.
The most illusioned society on the planet. I wonder how you measure something like that. This is Joe Meyer. We're streaming live. KBOO Portland from Freedom Rectangle. Main Street comes right through it. I'm joined in the booth by Josh. Josh has been at this since the first March, at least. When did you first hear about it, Josh?
A few of my friends had told me about it, but I knew about Occupy Wall Street. I was just waiting for it to explode into the rest of the country.
Did you catch on to it before even that first march when I saw you there?
Yeah, I was following Occupy Wall Street. I'm a New Yorker, so it's important for me to see what was going on back home and how they were dealing with, you know, because it's a very different culture over there. It's very run by, you know, you see people who work on Wall Street, people who work for, you know, the brokers and the hedge fund managers and all those things, and you see them all the time, and you see what they have, and you see what you don't have, and all the people who have even less than you do. Sure. Out here, it's kind of the same way, but not as big as New York, and just sitting in Wall Street and seeing it happen is kind of very, very symbolic towards our point in history.
Right. Are you surprised it's lasted so long in New York?
No. New Yorkers are very resilient. They they don't let anybody tell them what they can or can't do, which is, I think, it's putting a lot more strength into the whole movement by itself. You know, New Yorkers, they tend to... even though you might be right, if you say it the wrong way, you're totally wrong. And they see that, you know, very, very large corporations, multinational corporations, getting their hands into politics, and not only in America, but in other countries. And they see that happening, and they're saying, wow, this is completely wrong.
It's right under their nose somehow, so it's more aggravating, or you feel like you can do something about it because it's right there.
Yeah, I mean, not to take any power away from all the rest of the occupations, all of them are equally important and they all lend their hand into making this thing happen. It's just a very, it's a very amazing thing to see it come from New York, where people tend to think it's all about consumerism and it's all about the marketplace and it's all about those things. And to see the population where it kind of is centered around be angry about it is very, it's very empowering towards kind of the rest of the country, the rest of the world. I mean, the rest of the world is helping us out when it comes to it. They all are giving us the power to do what we're doing. But I think it all plays out in the same way. I just have New York on my mind.
Yep. What do you think about New York police, New York politics? I heard they were going to try to sweep them out at least once. Did you hear much about that?
I heard a few different things about them trying to sweep people out. I think at the end of the day, there's no way that they can do it illegally without it having the movement grow.
Yeah.
I think that people know that when they see, police brutality and just people not being able to speak their minds and have their free speech that we're entitled to, the movements tend to grow. People tend to be more behind it. And I think that if they try to, New Yorkers are going to stand solid in there. And just like Portlanders are, just like, you know, Washington people are, and just like everybody else, everybody's just going to stand strong and say, no, this is the end. This is where we change it.
What's that statement look like? Simply occupying or more direct action?
I think I've been talking to a lot of people, and it's kind of been shaping my idea of the occupation. The occupation itself, living inside of this community, doesn't necessarily change all of the problems that we're looking for to change. I think that it's teaching us how to live inside of this kind of communal way and see how we can all work together from all different walks of life, all different races and shapes and sizes and everything, and see how we can all do it. I think it's just a hub for people to see the change happening. It's like manifesting itself inside of a visual, you know, scope to people, just driving by, just seeing it in the news and everything. And I think that we have to grow out into the community and say you don't have to just occupy in a camp. You can occupy from home. You can occupy in the streets. You can join us on the marches. You can tell us what you think about different legislation, what you think about what needs to be changed, what's good for you and your family and your community. I think that the occupation camp itself is just kind of, kind of the nucleus of where it all comes from, but it's going to take the entire community getting involved for it to actually happen.
Do you see any dangers facing this camp here? I mean, I just talked to a gentleman, Tony, about possible violence in Seattle, which would presumably compromise the camps there. Anything here on?
I think Portland itself tends to be usually in like a pacifist kind of place. Not to say that people aren't willing to fight for, you know, what they believe in. It's just people tend to assert themselves to more of a verbal communication rather than a physical one, and that relationship with the police is going to have to be upheld. Not to say that I agree with the institution of the police, but just to say that we don't need anybody getting beat up, we don't need anybody getting hurt or anything like that. But at the same time, I think if it does come down to that, it won't kill the movement. I don't think that I think our biggest enemy is ourselves. We have to not be complacent. We have to keep a focus on what we're doing. We have to actually be the changes that we're trying to make, or that we're working to make, I should say. But I think at the end of the day, the police and all the outside forces are something that can't ever break us down. The only thing that can break us down is ourselves.
Right. I've seen you at several of the General Assembly meetings. Have you been pretty active? Are you part of any committees and so forth?
I'm just putting together kind of a subjugate of the outreach committee to go out to the community and try to get people round up to get them to marches and get them to the GAs and things like that. I've been stepping into different communities, entities all along, different committees and all these things, and helping out with food and information and all these different things. I think that everybody's job is everything's job. Everybody has to do everything, essentially, for it to actually work. And the committees are there because they're an outlet to be able to go and speak your mind and do it in more of like a focused and objective way. I also think the GAs are a good place to be able to get things done. I just kind of wish it was an easier way for people to actually want to go and get involved and do the things that we are trying to do. But, you know, it's all a process, and it's all going to take us understanding each other for it to work.
No doubt. You mentioned you're from New York. What brought you out west?
My brother. You know, my brother was out here. He was just kind of like, hey, you need a place to go, because I was just bored in New York, not doing anything. Just decided, hey, why not go see what the West Coast is all about? And here I am.
Portland's treating you all right so far?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great place. It is not New York by any means. Yeah. It is what it is. Portland's a good place, though. It's got a lot of love in its heart.
Yeah,
it's good.
I'm a scientist by training, and I'm always looking for that one key solution. Is there any concrete things you want to point to that you definitely want to see come out of this? Any change in legislation or the way we do things?
Localization. That's the one thing I think needs to happen. I mean, if you look at anything that we do, the way we transfer food, when it comes to oil, or the way that we actually eat or get our water, and how much of an environmental impact factory farms have, and right. all of these different things, and the way governing is done, the federal government has to try to say what's right for Delaware when it's trying to say what's right for Phoenix. It doesn't make any sense. We need to localize our governments. We need to be able to be actively involved as people.
Some more state power, take away from the federal government, move things more local.
More community power. I mean, we don't have to have these titles of state and all these different things. I mean, that system obviously isn't working for us. I think we need to actually be able to involve ourselves as a community, as all of the people coming together, rather than just picking somebody who's going to try to make the choices for us when people have, you know, people are people.
Another guest, I think it was yesterday, talked about direct democracies, where you would vote on single issues. I think several European countries have referenda like that. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think there's a bunch of different ways it can work. I mean, we could change the way that the system works now and the way that we vote. We could try to make it so that we have like community-minded GAs. Almost like that. It would almost be kind of the same as a town hall meeting, but not really. I mean, again, we have enough technology and enough capability to be connected with the outside world to gather the information we need to make decisions. But as far as decision making goes, I think that it should be dealt with between the people that it actually involves and not people that don't understand what's going on. You know, like decisions, perfect example, decisions for the homeless should be made with the involvement of the homeless, not just the people who say where the homeless should go or what they should be. Should be the people that are actually involved in it, that are living through it, that should make those decisions based on their own life, not just, you know, somebody speaking for them.
Sounds like good common sense. Do you see change happening gradually, or is it going to be more of a catastrophic and then rebuilding?
Depends on how it works. You know, I mean, there could be a catastrophic failure in the economy, where we're all just completely kicked out of our homes, and, you know, riots ensue, and all these, you know, crazy fire and brimstone revolution, all this stuff. That could happen. Or we could try to systematically change the system that we're working with. I think it needs to be kind of in the middle ground. I think we need to have a revolution of the mind and of the spirit in our country. Enough of this automation, enough of being robots. We need to be people again. And once that happens, we can start to change the system that these people decide to live in. We have to change ourselves to be able to create the system that works.
What's the difference between a human and a robot then? Is it human connection or what?
Well,
how can you tell?
Robots were made by humans. Humans were made by humans. So I think that at the end of the day, robots can't relate to what a human can do. I mean, I can look at that dude walking by and just say, hey, he looks like a nice guy.
Yeah.
Robots can't really do that.
So it's more about human-human interactions.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the themes that I'm starting to learn after being down here for quite a while is what we're doing is making new human connections. And that's the revolution.
Exactly.
Like you say, if the tents disappear, the movement can go on.
Yeah, exactly. And it will go on because we won't stop. We can't stop.
Right. One thing an earlier guest told me about was that the police are telling homeless people all over town, I don't know if this is true, to come down here. Would that be a threat to occupy Portland?
I don't I don't foreseeably see people being here threat to occupy Portland. I mean, there could be somebody who's completely rich that acts completely ridiculous when they're in this camp. I mean, I think it's all personal. I think it has to do with the people. I mean, we can't pigeonhole people into acting a certain way because they come from a certain background. We have to say, hey man, you're a person. If you can't handle yourself, you can't be here. And that's it. That is what it is. You know? If they want to be here and they want to be my friend, I'm down.
They're welcome. Josh, thanks for talking to us today.
Totally, thank
you. Put it there, brother.
Totally.
Good luck to you.
Take care, man.
This is Joe Meyer again. We're broadcasting live from downtown Portland. Freedom Rectangle, Main Street comes right through it. We're trying to keep it as live as possible today. And we're joined by an ex-KBOO volunteer right here. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, my name is Everardo Duran. And, well, I'd like to invite everyone to come here to the Occupy Portland. This is an excellent gathering movement going on, and I think we should all participate on this. This is something unique, unique experience and opportunity for the whole community to come together and do something, participate in the change.
Yeah. What do you think brings people together? We've talked about we've talked to a lot of different people today. You know, what brought you down here specifically?
Well, I think the Hispanic community is mostly suffering all this inequality in this society. We have less access to education, for example, health, and especially on the immigration issue, you know what's going on all over the country, deportations, and it's terrible, especially for the Latino community, and that's the reason why we like to invite everyone to come and see what's going on.
To meet your neighbor.
Exactly.
To build some kind of community.
Exactly, yes. That is our job here. We do have a tent, the Latino committee, and it's really important for the rest of the community to come and check us out.
Where is your tent then?
It's right here in the northwest side of the corner, in the corner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How many people you got staying there?
We have three tents. About we spend the night at least three or four people every night, and we're switching every day. Yes. Okay.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the occupation is going to lead to some change to make a better tomorrow for you and me?
Well, definitely, there's going to be a change. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we're going to keep struggling, and we hope to see real deep changes so we can all have a better world in all senses.
I've been asking a lot of my guests if they would briefly trace their lives, say where you were born, where you were educated, and how you got to Portland, if you don't mind.
Nah, not at all. I came here to the United States in 1987, and I've been back and forth to Mexico. I was, you can say it, lucky to belonging to a middle class family, and I already had the all the documents necessary to come to this country.
Did you get your education in Mexico then?
Yes, I went 1 year to the university down there.
Okay,
and ever since I've been working in different places, in the fishing industry, on the field, construction, and it's not been really hard for me, but I do have, for example, ex-neighbors in Mexico which didn't have the opportunity to come legally, and they still don't have any documents, working on the field and risking every day to be stopped by the police, not having driver's license, and that is my story.
A lot of the news we got out of Mexico was related to the drug cartels and the power there. Do you have anything to say about that, or did you experience that?
Well, definitely, yeah. The drug wars is not working. I mean, we all know what it's all about. It's about the U.S. Extending their military policies all over so they can have more control in other states, like in Mexico. They don't care how many, really, how many lives are lost every day. As long as they keep selling weapons, you know, they also don't care about people here consuming all kinds of drugs from the South. It's just a farce.
It's just a tool to get what they want, in a way, the drug wars and drugs itself.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
What can we do about it?
Well, that's part of what we're doing here. You know, change that. I don't know. There's many proposals, you know.
Yeah.
Some people say that it could be a solution to legalize drugs, as what's going on in other countries, in Europe, for example. They don't have so much violence, and they have more accessibility for treatments for people who is addicted.
Yeah. Harm reduction, I think it's called.
Right, yeah.
But the U.S. seems to be slow to learn from other countries for some reason.
Yeah, yeah, that's how it is.
But you seem like a relatively happy fellow.
I try to be. Well, this is like another community. It's so fun to be there, you know. I would mention, though, that there is... this is not perfect, but... appreciate the work many people are doing, the organizers, the all the volunteers. They're doing a heck of a job, and we'll try to do our best here.
Yeah, that's what we can do. Thanks so much for stopping by and talking to KBOO.
Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks for inviting. Bye.
From California. Or from Florida. And so we have to begin to, as much as we can, build alternative systems that allow for self-sufficiency, because as things deteriorate, the corporate state isn't going to take care of us. The only thing they're going to do is try and control us.
I have a question for you. Do you suggest any books that they could read, your books? Or
yes. Democracy Incorporated by Sheldon Wolin, which he's probably our greatest living political philosopher. It's a book about the system we live under, which he describes as inverted totalitarianism. By that he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in classical totalitarian regimes, you have a reactionary or a revolutionary force that seizes power and changes the iconography and language and structure of the state. In corporate totalitarianism or inverted totalitarianism, they pay fealty to the constitution, electoral politics, and patriotism, and yet have so corrupted the levers of power as to render the citizenry impotent. And I think he's right. I mean, I talked to Wolin recently, not too long ago, and he said that the primary mechanisms of political control are credit, access to credit, and cheap manufactured goods. And the credit's dried up, and the goods aren't so cheap anymore. So I asked Wolin, if those two mechanisms of control are removed, people can't get credit, and suddenly life becomes prohibitively expensive. And for the 47 million Americans who live in poverty, they're now spending about 35% of their income on food. Could it flip into a more... something that resembled classical